Our next case is 2020-0031. Stilson Resources LLC versus the State of Ohio Public Works Commission et al. We have counsel here? Yes. All right, we'll start with the appellant. I'm presuming that's Mr. Walia. You have to unmute yourself, sir. There you go.
Good morning, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Appellants will please reserve 5 minutes of our overall 15 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Manny Walia, and I'm the general counsel for appellant Siltstone Resources, a landowner in Ohio. In 2013, a company called the Guernsey Development Corporation did not receive authorization from the state before selling property to my client. My argument today, Your Honors, begins by answering this question. What is the legal consequence of that entity, the Guernsey Development Corporation's failure to receive authorization before selling property? In other words, what are the available damages to the state? The trial court concluded, and appellants agree, that the state would receive liquidated damages for its out-of-pocket losses. Its out-of-pocket losses are $430,000. The liquidated damages formula in this case would yield to the state $7.3 million. The state, however, says that not only can it receive the Hardy liquidated damages award, but it also has the ability to seek injunctive relief to unwind 13 transactions, all flowing from that instance of the Guernsey Development Corporation's first sale. Your Honors, this damages issue is an issue about statutory interpretation. Indeed, the state agrees. On page 28 of its brief, the state says that the General Assembly in statute RC 164.26, quote, implicitly conferred the power, end quote, of seeking injunctive relief to the state. Implicitly confers. Your Honors, respectfully, that is incorrect. That is wrong because the statute, any statute governing alienability or restrictions on property rights, cannot allow for implicit conferences of power. To the contrary, the General Assembly must explicitly describe the state's powers. That test comes from this court. Recently, in 2000, this court in Symes said that a statute restraining alienation of private property, quote, should not be extended to include limitations not clearly described therein, end quote. Symes cited a case from this court from 1919 called State versus Dowden. In that case, the court used this clear language, quote, statutes which impose restrictions upon the use of private property, let me pause, exactly like we're talking about in this case. Let me continue with the quote. Those statutes, quote, will be strictly construed and their scope cannot be extended to include limitations not therein clearly prescribed, end quote. Your Honors, a statute regarding alienation or restrictions on property rights must be, according to this court's precedent for 101 years, strictly construed, and no limitations may be allowed unless they are clearly prescribed or clearly described. So what's the state's response on this key issue of statutory interpretation, Your Honors? The state does not address these cases. Nowhere in their brief does the state cite Symes, nor Moore versus Daubert, the 1919 case I mentioned. If we apply this basic bedrock statutory interpretation test, Your Honors, the conclusion will be clear. If we look at section 164.26, the key statute in question, which the state agrees, that statute does not have a single word about injunctive relief or equitable relief or rescission or any other sort of comparable injunctive relief language. To the contrary, the section authored by the General Assembly provides a remedy for the exact situation that we're talking about here, where a party doesn't live up to its word. And the remedy that it provides is liquidated damages. In fact, the words say the commission must or shall have remedies regarding liquidated damages. Put simply, Your Honors, the statute at issue cannot clearly describe that the state gets injunctive relief when it never uses those words at all.
Mr. Willey?
Yes.
Isn't the liquidated damages really more applicable to the administration of the grant?
It may be, Your Honor. We know that the statute talks about the commission being able to have policies for long-term control. And then we know that the legislature authored the ability for the state to get a remedy if the local government entity, like the GDC here or Guernsey Development Corporation, doesn't follow its word. So I think the statutory scheme notes that the injury is reparable and notes that if the entity who received the grant money doesn't follow the restrictions, the state can enforce by getting liquidated damages and its grant money back. The statute at issue would provide equitable relief only if it clearly described that. And it's
so, your theory is even the restrictions on use couldn't be enforced.
No, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The trial court and the Court of Appeals both held that the use restriction regarding putting structures on the surface.
I understand that, but your theory seems to be that the legislature agency has no authority to put a deed restriction in unless it's provided for in the statute.
Not quite, Your Honor. The commission has the power to put restrictions on use of the surface as it did. And as everyone in this case agrees, there's no disturbance of the surface. There's no structures being added to it.
There's no specific language in the statute giving them that authority.
That's correct. The use restriction flows from the long-term control, and there's no contention. No one disagrees with that. There's nothing happening on the surface. The point that I'm making—
I'm just trying to reconcile your statement, that statement, with your statement that the agency can't do anything unless unless it's specifically authorized to do so, as far as putting deed restrictions.
The key difference, Your Honor, if I may, is that the restriction here is on alienability. It is about the future use of the property, it's about the sale of the property, the conveyance, and that has a specific sort of respect in this state, going back to 1919. Anytime that the government is trying to tell individuals or entities what they can do in terms of selling, there are special rules going back to 1919 saying that this legislature must clearly describe those. So that's the key difference. The use restriction is not per se an alienability or a transfer of property restriction. And no one disagrees with the state's view there. We're all in agreement, the trial court and the Court of Appeals. The only disagreement that remains in the case is what to do about that clause four in the deed. It's called the deed restrictions or transfer. And that's the alienability question. To conclude here, the legislature did not provide a single word regarding equitable relief, and therefore it cannot meet the standard of clearly describing that restraint. In addition, I will note that the legislature does know how to do this, because in this same chapter, chapter 164, in a section regarding bonds, which is not at issue here, but in that section, which is called 164.09, the legislature provided, quote, for the availability of, quote, suits in equity, actions at law, or any combination of the foregoing. So, Your Honors,
this is where I'm having a hard time with your argument. So you're saying that language would allow them to impose a restraint on alienability?
That language just demonstrates that the legislature knew how to.
Okay, but you've already told me that some equitable relief would be okay here. So I'm just not sure how that helps you.
In this case, Justice DeWine,
You said a use restriction could be enforced in equity, even though it doesn't have that kind of language.
The use restriction is not a restriction on alienability. And
I understand, but you just read me something that talked about equitable relief generally.
Yes, to make the point, Your Honor, that if the legislature wanted to provide injunctive relief, it could have done so in this statute because it clearly knew how to do it and is aware of the longstanding precedent in this case that it must clearly describe that right. That's the point I was making. We respectfully seek that this court reverse the appeals court holding because nothing in this statute allows for equitable relief. The final point that I'll make is regarding proposition of law point number three, noting that the state commission, even if it deems it to have been a better notion to get injunctive relief, the state commission here cannot expand on the powers that are not given to it by the legislature. It is well settled in the state that an administrative agency only has regulatory power as it's delegated by the General Assembly. So the state is restricted or constrained to what the statute says regarding damages.
Okay, counsel, you reserved 5 minutes for Mr. Gibson at this point. Is that true?
Mr. Gibson is arguing on behalf of a friend of the court, Gulfport, and I believe he has 5 full minutes. And then I've reserved 5 minutes for Mr. Honest,
you're over your 10 minutes. That's my point. So we're going to let Mr. Gibson.
Thank you.
Mr. Gibson.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. Thank you, and may it please the court. And thank you for allowing me to address the court on behalf of amicus this morning. While the appellants have provided the court, we think, with sufficient grounds for reversal, we also believe that there are additional and, in some respects, simpler and more straightforward bases to reach that same conclusion in this case, both with respect to the enforcement of the deed restrictions and with regard to the validity of the alienation restriction itself. I'll begin with the enforcement restriction, and that is, regardless of questions of statutory authority, there are two reasons why the deed itself and the language in the enforcement provision make it so that injunctive relief is not available in this case. The first is the liquidated damages provision, and it's specifically as it relates to the question of irreparable harm. Certainly, the state is right that irreparable harm may be presumed in cases of deed restrictions, but it is only a presumption and it can be rebutted. And when a party stipulates in its contract that liquidated damages will be, in fact, adequate compensation at law for a breach of the deed restrictions, then that presumption is rebutted. The only other argument the commission offers is that liquidated damages and injunction are, in fact, complementary remedies and not mutually exclusive. But as Ohio case law makes clear, and even the cases that the commission cites makes clear, that is in the instance in where a past completed breach is being remedied by the liquidated damages, but a future potential breach is being prohibited by the injunction to avoid a prospective irreparable harm. But this is only, I would say, the secondary problem with the injunctive relief request that the commission has made. The primary problem is that of rescission. The statutory language, the commission's own briefs, and the deed enforcement provision itself all contain clear language indicating that in the event of a breach, particularly in the statute when it relates to the long-term ownership or control requirements, is a breach that can be remedied and must be remedied by grant repayment. The commission does not dispute that that is rescissionary in nature. The commission also does not dispute that a rescission of a contract means that the contract cannot subsequently be enforced by injunction or otherwise, because it is a complete destruction of the contract. It is a return of the consideration that the commission would have given for the very deed restrictions it's asking the court to enforce prospectively. And so the problem becomes what happens after the breach when a mandate from the legislature that says, if there's a breach, you must seek to rescind the contract by taking back the grant money, and in fact, taking back the grant money times two. And the answer is there is nothing left to be enforced. Once that remedy is awarded, the case is over and the deed restrictions are in fact lifted. The money is deposited into the Clean Ohio Fund for recovered grant funds, and the commission is permitted to go ahead and utilize those to award another grant or grants. but it is not permitted to in perpetuity collect back its grant money two times that. In this instance, it would be 13, it would be 26 times the grant money as the bare minimum, according to the theory that the commission has asserted, and then to continue to enforce those deed restrictions ad infinitum. The practical absurdity is the outgrowth of the legal incorrectness of this view. Finally, the commission asserts, though, that it can choose then. If there's an absurdity there, it can choose between the rescissionary remedy the remedy of the injunction looking forward. But that also is...
Council, under your proposal here, then, the land goes back to Guernsey County, correct?
Or it stays with Guernsey County, right, as the owner of the fee simple, correct? Okay.
All right, so it stays with Guernsey County and there's no restrictions on what they do with that land.
Correct, because a rescission of the grant would be a termination of the agreement that gave rise to those restrictions.
Okay, but they still have their deals in place with, you know, your clients and others.
That's
for the
correct.
Mineral. Okay. And so the object that the, I'm presuming, citizens of Guernsey County sought to begin with, which was a restoration and a preservation of this stretch of land along the river or waterway, won't occur.
We would quarrel with that, particularly as it relates to the breach argument. From an enforcement perspective, if the consequence is that the deed restrictions are in fact lifted as a result of the rescission, you're absolutely right that it wouldn't be a Clean Ohio property anymore. There, in fact, has not even been a breach of those restrictions, and this relates to the alienation issue. The only theory of breach that's been advanced in this case is a theory of transactional breach. There's no indication anywhere in the record or even in the arguments of the parties that there has been anything that has disrupted the actual use of the property, the surface of the property. And so what the commission is seeking to do is to take what is a draconian restriction on the alienation of property and to create what we have described in the briefing as a false conflict between the public policy of conservation and the public policy of oil and gas development. And that false conflict cannot be found in the factual record, nor can it be found anywhere in the constitutional or statutory language.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, is there any argument, though, that but for the funds supplied by the Public Works Commission, which are really to further the benefits of the people and in terms of having land that's undisturbed and preserved, Guernsey County wouldn't have had the opportunity to buy this property. So is it enough to just say, smack their hand and say, okay, yeah, you still own it. You can do whatever you want to with it, but you know, just pay us twice what you were originally paid for it. We shouldn't consider anything about that?
Well, Justice Brunner, I think the legislature has answered that when it states, at least with regard to ownership and control requirement breaches, that the commission is required to seek liquidated damages and rescission, repayment of the grant. And so when the legislature made that determination, certainly there can be an honest debate about whether or not that was the proper enabling statutory language to administer the program. But at this stage, the court's only question is what did the legislature provide for as the remedy for such a breach if one occurred?
Okay, so who could have bought this property if Guernsey County hadn't bought it with the commission's grant? Could anybody have bought this property?
I'm not entirely aware of what Guernsey County Community Development Corporation's position was, whether they absolutely needed the grant in order to purchase it or simply wanted it because they felt that it fit within their objectives. I don't believe that there was anything regarding who could purchase the property other than a willing and able buyer, is my understanding.
Maybe somebody else can answer it as we go through the argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. The Guernsey County Community Development Corporation voluntarily sought and willingly accepted public funds. As you heard today, they accepted those public funds for the purpose of preserving certain property. And even before the Development Corporation applied for those public dollars, it knew that if it received public money, that money would come with certain restrictions. Among them was a restriction that the Development Corporation would be required to maintain long-term ownership and control of any property purchased with public dollars. And the Development Corporation knew that the Public Works Commission could enforce the grant restrictions either through legal and equitable means. All of these terms were spelled out in the clear, unambiguous deed language that was then recorded for everyone to see. Now, the Development Corporation and a variety of oil and gas companies have violated the clear and unambiguous language of the deed, and they asked the court to overlook those violations. The court, however,
why aren't the liquidated damages an adequate remedy for that violation?
Several reasons, Your Honor. First, it is a longstanding principle, both with respect to land and generally, that liquidated damages are not an adequate remedy. With land, this court has said time and again, as many other courts have said, that when you're dealing with land, specific performance is an available remedy, even when there is a damages provision. But putting that aside, liquidated damages simply do not flip the presumption of an adequate remedy. Respectfully, Mr. Gibson gets it exactly wrong when he says that having a liquidated damages clause means that there is a presumption against equitable relief. We'd point the court to the cases that we cite on pages 29 and 30 of our brief, where this is spelled out in great detail, and where we say that having a liquidated damages clause does not presume that you cannot receive injunctive relief. And indeed, we cite cases throughout our brief, starting with Ewing v. Davis from the 7th District of Ohio in 1903, all the way up through Messavi v. Russell and v. Boyer in the 10th District in 1992, where you have an ability to receive both.
Aren't those generally cases where the liquidated damages go to the past damages and the injunctive relief goes to the future harm? Isn't this different?
Yes, Your Honor. And we would contend and we believe that that is exactly the situation you have here, is we are seeking prospective injunctive relief requiring a return of the property to the Guernsey County Development Corporation so that they can, in the future, maintain the long-term ownership and control they agreed to when they sought this grant.
And do you want the liquidated damages too, or just the injunctive relief?
Our complaint thus far has requested both, and liquidated damages would have to show that there's some past harm that has occurred. So you have a question of past harm to the property for which liquidated damages may be available, and prospective injunctive relief unwinding these title transactions. And so that is no different than any of the other cases that we've cited and that courts have found that these are complementary remedies. And
why does there have to be an unwinding of the transfer in order to, moving forward, keep the intent with the land grants, the intention of giving the land grants? Why can't those still be monitored and adhered to without unwinding the sale?
Two reasons, Justice Stewart. One is a reason related to the deed restriction, and two is related to a statute that applies to who may receive these types of grant dollars and grant-funded property in the first place. And I'll begin with the second, which is the statute, because the General Assembly has made clear in Revised Code 164.27A that the only entities that are able to receive grant funds or hold grant-funded property are local political subdivisions or nonprofit organizations. And here, there have been a variety of transfers in many private entities, as you've seen today before you, that claim an interest. And so one, you would need to unwind these to comply with that statutory requirement on how these dollars can be used. But two, it goes back to the transfer restriction itself, because not really heard much about that language of that transfer restriction, and certainly not the first sentence. And the Development Corporation, in the first sentence of the transfer restriction, agreed that the grant was specific to the grantee and that approval of the grantee's application was made in reliance on that grantee's continued ownership and control of the property. And so the agreement here is that the Guernsey County Community Development Corporation agreed that it would hold on to the property unless approval was given by the Public Works Commission. And so in that respect, injunctive relief is necessary to ensure that the Development Corporation continue to comply with the terms that it agreed to in exchange for public dollars. In this respect, the limitations.
Counsel, let me ask you about the, is my understanding correct that there's no surface disturbance as a result of the mining operations going on below by the appellants here?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I'll give you the yes answer first, is no activity has actually taken place. And here's the no answer. The Seventh District found that the leases here authorized certain activity. They said, well, the leases authorized the drilling of wells, cutting of timber, laying of pipelines and roads. And so the Seventh District invalidated certain portions of the lease. And so I know there's been a characterization that there's been no violation of the
well, if those provisions were struck, you know, that you can't surface drill, you can't cut down this timber, and you can't install roadways that are going to be in conflict with the original intent of returning this property to its natural state, you know, for the enjoyment of the community. Could that not be, there's nothing to preclude the community development folks renegotiating with the state. Is that correct?
I'll try to answer it, and if I don't answer it fully, please just let me know. Certainly in the use restriction context, that may be true, but in so there's the question of surface activity and continued use and how that relates to the use restriction. And then there's also the transfer restriction, which is broader. And the Guernsey County Development Corporation, at the time it accepted public funds, said that it would not transfer any interest in the property. And so that is not dependent on how the surface is being used. And certainly, if the development corporation had wanted to do something with this property, had wanted to transfer, the deed does allow them to come to the Public Works Commission and ask for permission to transfer a interest in the property. Now, the development corporation knew at the time it sought the grant, the publicly available policies of the Public Works Commission said that no new oil and gas leasing or oil and gas development would be permitted. But if the development corporation wanted to ask the Public Works Commission for releasing that term, it could. If the development corporation wanted the General Assembly to change the language, it certainly could. And notably, neither the development corporation nor any of the oil and gas companies here took either of those steps. They just went ahead, violated the clear and unambiguous terms of the deed. And then now when there's been enforcement, they've tried to invalidate those and avoid responsibility for their decisions. Your Honor, I if the court has questions about the validity of the transfer restriction and the alienation restriction.
I have questions. We have longstanding case law that says restrictions on inalienability are invalid. Why should this case be an exception?
Your Honor, I don't think it is an exception. I think your case law is not as broad as the development corporation and the oil and gas companies suggest. The court's case law and the case law of the common law does recognize that certain restrictions on alienation will generally be found to be invalid. And most of those apply in the context of donative transfers, testators trying to exert dead hand control. But if you look to the Ohio Society for Crippled Children and Adults decision, this court recognized that when you have an alienation restriction that is imposed for a public purpose or a charitable purpose, those alienation restrictions will generally be upheld.
Well, but there was a reason why it said they would be upheld in that case, is because you could go to a court and seek to get around them, whereas that's not really the case here.
You can go to the General Assembly in this case. So you may not go to a court, but this...
How can you go to the General Assembly and ask them to change a deed?
Because in this case, Your Honor, the deed is with the state. If this was a deed between two private parties, then maybe you would have a tougher argument. But when the state itself is the one that holds the interest in the alienation restriction, the General Assembly is free to say, we as the state...
But that's the case with anyone that someone has a contract with, right? Anyone who transfers a deed, presumably you could go to them and ask them to get rid of the restriction. And that's never been considered enough.
Your Honor, I think that the difference here is, again, the purpose, the public purpose. These are public dollars. And again, the arguments that
doesn't the use restriction protect that public purpose?
It protects the public purpose to a certain degree. But as I said, Your Honor, there are two additional reasons, or at least three additional reasons. First, there's a clear, explicit statutory command. The General Assembly, in two places, in Revised Code 164.26 and 164.23, has made clear that long-term ownership and control of these properties must be maintained. And so that alone trumps.
Well, that's not exactly.
Wait.
That is it. I mean, it shall include provisions for long-term ownership. It doesn't say there has to be. There doesn't say there has to be a deed restriction.
Two things, Your Honor. First, that's not the only provision. Revised Code 164.23 says a grant applicant must also demonstrate how they intend to maintain long-term ownership and control. And so there is the better reading is an instruction from the General Assembly. And two, even the reading that my friends on the other side offer, they simply need to adopt policies. That presumes that at some point, the Public Works Commission has the authority, and maybe not in every case, but it still presumes the validity of a restriction that requires long-term ownership and control.
Counsel, going back to that sentence, though, that you mentioned, it says long-term control through a lease or a purchase of an easement. It doesn't talk about an alienation provision.
Your Honor, I think you could fairly characterize the deed restrictions here as an easement. And I draw the court's attention to conservation easements, which are authorized by Revised Code 5301.68. And there, when they're talking about easements, the General Assembly says these may be in the form of articles of dedication, easement, covenant restrictions, or conditions. And so I think that the term easement there is a broad term that encompasses and in the General Assembly intended to encompass the deed restriction language here. And so I think that the deed restriction language does comply with 164.26 and its requirement that there be an easement requiring long-term ownership and control. And so I think the answer to Justice Dwine's first question that got us down this path is there's a statutory command. And the statutory command to maintain long-term ownership and control trumps any public policy that may exist with respect to alienation restrictions. Second, the answer I gave, I think, to Justice Stewart about the transfer restriction here serves the interest of 164.27A, which is it serves the interest of who is entitled to have grant-funded property and receive grants. And then the third, it's sort of an implicit reason that furthers the use restriction. And so in this case, you had a oil and gas lease, and that is a transfer of a property interest that would violate the deed restriction unless the Public Works Commission approved it. And as I said, that oil and gas lease violated the use restriction, which is why the Seventh District invalidated certain portions. If the Public Works Commission had been given an opportunity to review that at the outset, it could have prevented any transfer that authorized surface use and would have eliminated the need to go to court to protect this property. And so there is an implicit benefit here of requiring restrictions on alienation, requiring approval before alienation, because it does advance at least implicitly the public use restriction that, again, the Guernsey County Development Corporation agreed to in exchange for these public dollars.
Yes. When I look at the Ohio Society for Crippled Children and Adults, again, part of its focus is that it's for a charitable or a public purpose, and that the inalienability of the land is to sort of maintain that charitable or public purpose. Now, a community development corporation could be definitely a nonprofit, or it's a non-governmental organization connected to the county, but it's a development organization. So was it appropriate for the Public Works Commission to grant those funds to the Community Development Corporation when it seems like by its purpose, it's going to do something to try to develop the land?
Your Honor, the Development Corporation doesn't necessarily have to develop the land. Certainly, it could be envisioned that the could develop the community by attracting tourism through a park. Here, what they sought to do is they sought to protect the riparian corridor and protect the Leatherwood Creek stream. And so this is part of a whole larger project. And so I don't think that simply because development is in the Development Corporation's name, that they would necessarily be limited to developing the land in the way of building or constructing on it. The development can take a variety of forms.
Thank you.
Justice Bruner, I did want to answer a question that you had asked earlier about the funding and the purchase of this property. My understanding is when the property was available for purchase, anyone could have purchased it. And here the state provided 70% of the purchase price. And that, when I say 70%, that could even be a greater percentage of the dollars, because there's a limitation on how much funding someone can receive from a Clean Ohio Conservation Fund grant, and you can have an in-kind contribution. So here we know the state provided at least 70% of the purchase price, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the other 30 came in dollars. It may have come in-kind contributions, and that I cannot answer, but I know you had asked that question earlier.
Thanks. Yeah, that's pretty typical with grants and nonprofits. Makes sense. Thank you.
And I see my time is running a little short. I just wanted to briefly touch on the rescissionary argument and any other questions the court may have related to the injunctive relief. I already explained why the basis of the status of the law is simply having a liquidated damages clause does not mean that you cannot seek injunctive relief. We think that nothing the General Assembly said in Revised Code 164.26 changed that. In fact, the General Assembly would have needed to prohibit injunctive relief if it wanted to, as the court has said time and again. I know, Justice Kennedy, you noted this in a recent concurrence, that the General Assembly is presumed to know the status of both the common law and the statute law and needs to be explicit if it wants to change that. And so we think that the General Assembly would have needed to explicitly prohibit injunctive relief rather than authorize it. But turning to the rescissionary question, this wasn't a rescission of a grant, this was a breach. And as we've already discussed, the measure of damages doesn't mean that that is an exclusive remedy. And even that argument fails on its own terms if you look at 164.26, because if this was a rescission, you couldn't get liquidated damages. The idea of rescission is that's all you get, is you get your money back. But the General Assembly says you get both liquidated damages and grant repayment. And so that's best understood as a measurement of damages, not as authorizing some sort of rescissionary remedy. And so for these reasons, because the deed language is clear, no one has argued that there is any ambiguity, because it is authorized by statute, we think that the court should hold the transfer restriction is valid. And then we think the deed language is again clear with respect to injunctive relief, the status of the law, both respect to specific performance regarding land, many courts, you know, many cases from this court and others, and the many cases holding that an injunctive relief is still available in liquidated damages. We would ask the court to hold the transfer restriction.
How would that work? The point of having liquidated damages is so a court doesn't have to do a damage calculation, but you're saying that you could have equitable relief going forward, but still liquidated damages to compensate for the past harms. How would you calculate what those liquidated damages were?
Your Honor, I think that is the essence of, like you said, liquidated damages exist so that the court does not need to calculate it. I think you would have to show some damage. You have to show the property was changed in some way, whether it's on this, whether the property interest.
So that there'd be no bar to them getting a double recovery for the state then?
I think that is an argument. As we said in our brief, the courts haven't faced this argument.
Tell us what you think that if we bought your argument and remanded it, what a court would do on remand as far as calculating liquidated damages for the state and fashioning equitable relief.
I think the first step, Your Honor, would be once you unwind the transactions that violated the transfer restriction, taking a look at the property. And that would be looking at two things, looking at the surface of the property, was that changed in some way? And then just looking at the whole of the property interest. was the property interest that was conveyed back to the state the same as the property interest that existed before any of these violations occurred? And I think the state would first have to show that some damage occurred in either one of those contexts. Yes.
Counsel, well, they showed some damage occurred, would they get the full amount of liquidated damages or?
I don't want to prejudge our arguments. In this case, I'd like to remind the court, before anything happened, the trial court held that we could only seek liquidated damages. We couldn't seek injunctive relief. And then immediately—
I think if you want both, you ought to explain how that would work because—
Well, Your Honor, I explained that we would have to show the damages, that the property was damaged. And if we can make that showing, then we can seek the liquidated damages to which the parties agreed in exchange for public dollars. This was a contract. It was an arm's length transaction between the Community Development Corporation and the state. The Development Corporation agreed to certain terms. And so at the very least,
the state would come out way ahead. They get a lot more than they get the property back and they get the liquidated damages amount.
I don't know that I could say, Your Honor, whether the state would come out ahead or not, because if the state cannot prove damages, if the state cannot prove that any damage has occurred, then all they would get would be the property back. But if they can prove that the property was damaged, then the state would get
that doesn't sound like liquidated damages at all. Yeah. That sounds like some kind of actual damage calculation that you.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily right, Your Honor. Maybe it is closer to an actual damages calculation if you were trying to show what the value of the damage is. But here, all I'm saying is that you'd have to show damage. Whether you don't necessarily have to show the value of the damage, but in order to invoke liquidated damages, you would at least have to show that the property was damaged, which would mean, is the state getting back that which it originally paid for?
Counsel, that goes to my question about you don't like rescission, it sounds like, and yet you're asking for equitable relief with an injunction. Aren't you required to do equity to get equity?
I guess I'm a little confused.
Well, I'm going back to jolly old England and early American law, where to ask for an injunction from the chancellor, you have to agree to do equity. And rescission is an equitable remedy. So how can you get an injunction without and say we don't have to do rescission?
Your Honor, I guess I would point to the court to the cases I've cited earlier, and I don't know if this is adequate to answer your question. But in the Ewing v. Davis case and the Messam v. Russell case, you had a forward-looking injunction, and you had a backwards-looking damage. And so that's not a rescission. That is simply damage for past harms that have occurred and injunction to prevent future harms. And that's what we're asking for here in this case. That's not a rescission. That is simply stop the harm and abide by the restrictions you agreed. And then if there are damages for past harm, we should receive damages for past harm that has occurred.
Well, from what I hear then, you're asking going forward, forget the past damages, okay? You're asking us to enforce the contract, but you don't want to have to go back to the beginning of the contract and give them back rescission.
I think we may be talking about rescission and who gets what back. We paid money to purchase this property in exchange the Development Corporation agreed to certain terms. What we are asking is that the Development Corporation going forward be held to those terms. And I don't see that there's anything necessarily that we would need to return. All we are doing is seeking to enforce the arm's length terms to which the Development Corporation.
So the state does not get this property back, as was mentioned by, I'm not sure who, under a scenario that we're getting, the state would get twice the liquidated damages by a showing of damages, plus get the property back. The property at the end of the day would stay with Guernsey County or this development corporation. They just have to abide by the terms of their original contract.
Yes.
That's what you're asking for.
Yes, that's what we're asking for, exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so I know I'm over time. I'm happy to entertain additional questions, but for the reasons that we've given today and the reasons in our brief, we would ask the court to affirm the Seventh District, hold that the transfer restriction is enforceable, and that at least with respect to forward-looking, a injunction is available to enforce those terms.
Mr. Peterson, before you go, can I ask this question?
Sure.
You want a green space along the river. It's a reclaimed strip mining facility. And let's say the green space is there remaining intact for the public to use. But what if the platform for oil and gas collection is not on the green space, nowhere within the property, and they're able to access and produce minerals and oils as a result of it, somewhere off that and without violating your contract, then what do you say?
I'd say two answers, Your Honor. I think there's an answer based on the use restriction and the transfer restriction. And we would agree that that would not violate the use restriction. It would, however, violate the transfer restriction because an oil and gas interest is an interest in the property, and transferring that away would violate the transfer restriction. Now, if that becomes an issue, the General Assembly is free to adopt policies or adopt statutes that authorize that type of activity. In fact, that's what the General Assembly did when it created the Ohio Oil and Gas Leasing Commission. It created a process by which state-owned land could be leased for oil and gas development. And so if the General Assembly, if oil and gas companies and community development corporations wanted to go to the General Assembly and say, here is all this land, we can't transfer it away because of the terms of the Clean Ohio Conservation Fund, we would like you to create a process by which we could access that, you could waive the transfer restrictions because it's held by the state, they're free to ask the General Assembly to do that. What they're not free to do is simply disregard the plain language of a contract to which they agreed. Again, they didn't ask the General Assembly for permission. They didn't ask the Public Works Commission for permission. They're just here trying to invalidate a contract in the plain language. And so I hope that answers your question. Happy to answer any follow-up, but if there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will return now for rebuttal by Mr. Onest.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, you know, we are dealing with a single sentence about what remedies are available to the Ohio Public Works Commission for violation of long-term ownership and long-term control restrictions. And the legislature has said those are liquidated damages and grant repayment for any failure to comply. Now, our questions are, does the Ohio Public Works Commission fall within that authority, that limited authority that it is given by the General Assembly when it demands a deed restriction which permits it to seek equitable relief? The answer is no. It acted outside its authority. Two, does the Ohio Public Works Commission act outside its authority when it asks a court for equitable relief? The answer is yes. It acted outside its limited power. The Ohio Public Works Commission has it backwards. It is not about what the General Assembly may not have said. It's about what it did say. And it did say, set your policies for long-term ownership and control. And if there is a violation or a breach, you provide for monetary relief. That is the limit. General Assembly has spoken, and that's what we have to apply the statute as it's written, limiting remedies to money. And so for that reason, we have to overturn and reverse the Seventh District and reinstate the trial court's decision. And Justice Kennedy brings up the green space issue. There is no indication in this case that there's any sort of use restriction violation or that the green space is being threatened. In fact, I believe the producers in this case are indicating that the green space will be maintained to the best of everyone's ability and that there's not going to be any surface use for this property.
Mr. Onest, 164.02 and 0.05 authorize the Ohio Public Works Commission to, quote, do all other action, enter into contracts, and execute all instruments necessary or appropriate to carry out this chapter. Why wouldn't that, under that umbrella of do all other action, include seeking an injunction in equity?
Your Honor, so first in one, Revised Code 164.26A is a specific statute talking specifically about the remedies that the Ohio Public Works Commission may impose. That specific statute would control over the general statute that you're talking about. The court, and we cite to the DABE decision, I refer to it as the DAB decision. There was a grant to local public health boards at the county level to do all things necessary to promote public health. So what do? They put in a general smoking ban. Well, this court said, even though you're allowed to put any regulations which are necessary for promoting public health, power is not absolute. So when you look at the fact that power cannot be absolute with an administrative agency like this, and then you couple it with the specific statute which governs the remedies that can be imposed, negotiated, and sought, you have to apply that specific remedial statute because it is clear on its face. The policy shall provide for proper liquidated damages and grant repayments for those failures. So the specific controls over the general, Your Honor. I know I'm over my time allotted here, Your Honors, but all I would say is that in closing, the monetary damages that could be sought in this case are significant. We're not talking about low sums. Undoing the transactions does not further the Clean Ohio Fund here. There is no indication that any sort of green space is going to be violated. And for those reasons and for the reasons discussed earlier, we believe that the Seventh District's decision should be reversed and the trial court's decision should be reinstated.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.